Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to get to be with you today. For those of you who've been coming to Ankeny for a while and have heard me talk before, you know I'm a self-confessed nerd, right? And so like in high school, my big thing was being on the debate team, right? This is like my safe haven, right? You have a nerd, you got to find that sanctuary where you kind of fit in. But every now and then, events would happen that would take you out of your safe place into your scary place, right? So I have this distinct memory when I was junior in high school. I'm at a debate tournament, trying to qualify for the state tournament, and I'm having a conversation with some other people, and a couple of them were other people on the debate team who went to the same church I did and were in the same youth group. And one of them says, "Have you heard the news?" I was like, "No, what's the news?" And said, "The news is Vice President Bush," this is back in 1988, he's running for president, "Vice President Bush is going to be at our church tomorrow morning." Now, I'm a political junkie, so my first thought, oh, that's really cool, right? And then the second thought was, wait a second. Tomorrow morning, I and several other guys from the youth group are supposed to do a song and dance number in front of the entire congregation to, like, preview the youth musical we're going to be doing in a couple weeks, and now I'm doing it in front of the Vice President of the United States. So, just so you know, doing what I'm doing now, that's my comfort zone. Singing and dancing, not my comfort zone, okay? Now, what got me thinking about this event is the particular musical our youth group was doing this year. So I got a little visual. Some of you guys may have seen this before. It's Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, right? And it's catchy and it's clever, and as I've thought about it, I mean, I've heard this, the soundtrack and score so many times, I still to this day have like most of it in my head. But it completely misses the point of the story of Joseph. I mean, absolutely misses the point of Joseph. The big rousing number at the end, the refrain is, "Any dream will do," which is the stupidest thing I have ever heard in my life. I mean, think about that for just a second. Any dream will do, right? Some dreams are mercilessly crushed, you know? Some dreams, you fulfill them and find out they're unsatisfying. Some dreams are trivial, some are selfish, some are vengeful, some are spiteful. It's just false, right, that any dream will do. And yet, that musical was in many ways prophetic and ahead of its time, because I think that is very much the spirit of our age now. Right? I meet people who believe Christianity is false and think doing what I'm doing is great as long as I believe in it and it's my dream. But that's not the story of Joseph. And the reason Andrew Lloyd Webber and company missed it is because the main character is missing from their version of the story. Right? God never actually appears. Joseph has a dream and his dream comes true. But what do we make of that if there isn't a God who is responsible for Joseph's dream coming true, right? Otherwise, Joseph's just a guy, right, who, you know, bought a lottery ticket and happened to hit the jackpot. That doesn't actually give me a good reason to go buy lottery tickets. Instead, I think if we will look at the story of Joseph and we'll see it for what it actually is, it is a call for all of us to take our dreams and our history and our sense of who we are and root those things in the promises and the plan of God. So let's take a look. We're going to be covering 37 to 50 out of Genesis. We've got a lot of ground to cover. Genesis chapter 37 begins the story of Joseph, and Joseph's going to be the main character here all the way through. And here's the basic setup, right? There's Abraham, who's called by God and given these amazing promises, promises that through him, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed, that he's going to have all of these descendants, that they're going to inherit land, right? There's all these promises that have been given to Abraham and then to his son Isaac and then to his son Jacob. And Jacob ends up with four wives, only one of which he actually likes, okay? And starts having lots of sons, but his favored wife, Rachel, is the one who's failing to have sons and failing to have sons. And finally, with a whole bunch of older brothers, Joseph is born. Joseph is at this point the only son of the favored wife, and he immediately becomes the favored son. And the father, Jacob, makes a point of letting the other sons know they're second rate,
right? So one of the things he does is he buys this really fancy coat of many colors and he gives it to Joseph as a way of showing that he's the favored one. And I know from the musical that it was red, yellow, green, brown, scarlet, black, ochre, peach, ruby, olive, violet, fawn, lilac, gold, chocolate, mauve, cream, crimson, silver, rose, azure, lemon, russet, gray, purple, white, pink, orange, and blue, okay? Now, if you're one of the brothers, you're not happy right now, right? He's wearing that and you're wearing goat skins, right? So to make matters worse, Joseph has dreams, right? And the point of these dreams is to tell his brothers and even his father and mother that one day they are all gonna bow down before him. In a culture like theirs that values age and seniority, this is not a way for Joseph to become more popular, right? And so Joseph also has brothers who are frankly evil men, right? They've slaughtered an entire village in Shechem in an act of revenge. They're not nice men. He sees them doing things that are evil. He tells his father they don't like that either. So the brothers grow to hate Joseph. And one day they see an opportunity, they decide they're gonna kill him. But then one of them, Judah, has an even better idea. He's like, hey, look, there's some traders passing by. What if we just sell him into slavery? We never have to see him anymore, and we actually make some money out of the deal. Sounds like a good idea, right? So they're like, fantastic idea, Judah. So they sell Joseph, and he is hauled off into slavery, right? And this is gonna begin 13 awful years of Joseph's life, of just terrible thing after terrible thing happening to him. And then in chapter 38, the story is gonna switch, and we have this odd chapter about Judah, right? From 37 to 50, Joseph is the main character all the way through, and then you get this chapter that's about Judah, and it's not a G-rated chapter in your Bible. And we see the same guy who just sold his brother off into slavery is a wicked man. His life goes like this. He gets married, he has some sons, his son gets married, but his son is a wicked man like his father, and God decides to strike him down. The customs of the day say that the next brother is supposed to be with the widow so that she can bear children, right? So that the family line is perpetuated. The next brother instead sexually exploits his brother's widow over and over again, and God gets fed up with it and puts him to death. Now Judah only has one son left, and he's afraid to have him go with the widow because he's like, I've only got two, and everyone who ends up with her ends up dead, and he doesn't want that. So he says, oh, someday in the future when he's a little older, but he doesn't do it. He has no intention of doing it. And eventually, the woman, Tamar, decides she's gonna take matters into his own hands. She knows Judah's going on a trip, so she takes off her widow's clothes and she dresses herself like a prostitute. Prostitutes in those days wore veils. And she just positions herself along the side of the road on the path he is gonna be taking. And I think she knows his character well enough to know he is not gonna walk by a prostitute without stopping for a conversation. And he does. They work out a deal. She has sex with him. He gives her some collateral. And a few months later, when word gets out that she's pregnant, Judah is leading the path to have her stoned to death because she's been acting like a prostitute, right? And here's what happens, right? She produces the collateral and says, you might want to think about whose child this is. And here's what Judah says. Judah says, she is more righteous than I, since I did not give her my son, Shelah, and he did not know her again. Judah is humiliated in front of the whole town here. And I think it's a beginning of a turning point in Judah's life, because he's able to actually see his own sin, see his own hypocrisy, and realize that he's not a righteous man. Now, he's been living the way he's been living for a long time. He's old enough to be a grandpa at this point. It's his lack of a grandchild that's created the whole problem. And I think the story is here, because we're gonna see by the end, Judah has a role to play in the story, and I think he's there to remind us that even people who for year after year after year have not walked in the way of God, there is still a way through repentance and faith for them to be a part of God's plan. Okay, now chapter 39 shifts us back to the story of Joseph. Joseph's now in Egypt. He finds himself working as a slave for Potiphar, who's a very powerful official in Egypt. And wherever Joseph goes, he serves. And he is a blessing to those he's serving, and they tend to prosper, right? And so he gets more and more responsibility, and eventually Potiphar's basically having him run the house. The only thing Potiphar has to worry about is whether to have a latte or a mocha. I mean, that's the kind of life Potiphar has. And things are going well for Joseph until his Potiphar's wife decides Joseph's a good-looking guy, and she wants to sleep with him. And day after day, Joseph is propositioned by her. Day after day, he says no, until finally, in exasperation, Joseph says this to her. Speaking about Potiphar, he says, "He's not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" Now, what's interesting here is you see, even living in exile, even after being sold into slavery, Joseph is intentionally orienting his life around God's plan and God's purposes, and he realizes that wherever he goes, God sees, God watches, right? He's responsible to God for how he lives. Now, his integrity is rewarded with him being falsely accused of sexual assault by Potiphar's wife and then being thrown in jail, right? So now he finds himself in prison, and his response to being in prison is to become a servant. Right? He starts helping out the guy who runs the prison. And before long, the guy who runs the prison has basically put Joseph in charge of the prison. Right? The inmate literally is running the prison in this case. Right? And then he meets two guys, a butler and a baker, who had both been officials in Pharaoh's court, and they have dreams. And Joseph says, "The God who I serve has given me the interpretation of your dreams. I'm going to tell you what they mean." So he does. He interprets the dream, and the dream interpretations are exactly right. He correctly prophesies that one of them is going to be killed, but the other is going to be restored to his position at Pharaoh's court. But the guy, the butler who goes to Pharaoh's court, once again forgets all about Joseph, and Joseph spends more years in prison. And then Pharaoh has a dream, and Pharaoh can't understand it. And at this point, the butler remembers, "Hey, I remember this guy back when I was in jail. He's good at this sort of thing." So they clean Joseph up. You know, you're going to be in Pharaoh's presence. They probably shave his head, because that's how Egyptians did things. And he's brought in, and here's what Pharaoh has to say to him, right? We're now in chapter 41. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I've had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. I've heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it." Joseph answered Pharaoh, "It is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer." Right? So notice how repeatedly Joseph is wanting God to get the glory and God to get the credit. He realizes this power of interpretation of dreams isn't something he has, right? It's something God does through him. So Pharaoh explains the dreams, and they're weird dreams, right? You've got, you know, seven really great, like, blue ribbon Iowa ears of corn, and then seven scrawny ears of corn, and apparently the corn have teeth because the bad corn eats the good corn. And there's seven cows, and the seven beautiful cows are then eaten by the seven scrawny cows, right? And Pharaoh's not sure to what to make of this, and Joseph says, "Here's the deal. What you've been given is a long-term weather forecast." Now, some of you grew up on farms. If you had an accurate 14-year weather forecast, how much money would that be worth? Right? And the meaning is there are going to be seven amazing years followed by 7 years of famine. And God's decided this. Pharaoh, your weather is actually controlled by my God, right? So Pharaoh's getting a lesson about who's actually sovereign, who's actually in control. And what Joseph says is you need to find someone who can oversee this so we can store up some of the excess food during the seven good years so that we have food set aside for the seven bad years. And Pharaoh says, "Joseph, you're the guy," right? So Joseph now goes from being in prison to now being the second most powerful man in all of Egypt, right? Now, this is an amazing transformation. And I want to stop and take it back. How does this happen, right? The odds to this kind of a rags-to-riches story are completely improbable. Your odds actually are better off buying a lottery ticket, right, than what happens to Joseph. Why does it happen to Joseph? I think it happens to Joseph because it's part of a promise that God had made. So remember the promises that had been made to Abraham. One of those promises was, through you, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. Right? Now, prior to Joseph, how much blessing has there been for the surrounding nations? Right? The town of Shechem did not feel blessed, right, as they are wiped out by Joseph's brothers. Right? They've made various kings mad by pretending their wives were their sisters. They haven't actually had a very good track record so far of blessing the nations. But God was going to be faithful to his promise, and I think Joseph understood what the promise meant and what the implications are. Right? Even though he had a dream that one day he was going to rise to a position of preeminence, he didn't just passively sit around waiting for it to happen. I think instead he reasoned like this. Well, look, I know the promise that through my family, all the nations of the earth are supposed to be blessed. So wherever I go, I am going to try to be a blessing, right? I am going to be a servant. And over again, that's the pattern. Wherever Joseph is, he serves and he blesses others. Now, here's why this is important. The dreams we have for the future and the way we see ourselves in the present, that shapes us, right? So let me give you an example, right? If, someone is constantly saying, hey, do the dishes. Hey, answer the door. Hey, could you do that? And you're like getting, like, why do you keep telling me to do all of these things? And the person says, because I hired you to be my butler. Remember that? Like, oh yeah, you're right. I guess this is part of the job description, right? And then you start doing it, right? In other words, when you're asked to serve, how you regard your service depends a lot on whether your identity includes servant or not. Because if you don't really think you're a servant and people ask you to be one, you're going to get angry and frustrated and bitter. On the other hand, if you have accepted as part of your story, that's actually who I am. I am called to be a servant. I am called to be a blessing to others and actually be freeing and flourishing. I guarantee you, Joseph is a healthier person and a happier person because he decided to focus on blessing others and serving others than if he had chosen just to sit around stewing over all the injustice that had been done to him. And there was a lot of injustice that had been done to him. And I think that's the next major part of the story, right? So Joseph's life is going well. We see God starting to work out some of the promised blessing. But we still have a family that has been torn apart by envy and bitterness. And it's key to God's promises to see how this family is going to be brought back together, how they're going to be reconciled. And I want us to stop and think about this. Joseph had had a terribly traumatic experience at the hands of his brothers. And I can't relate to that. I was thinking, like, what from my childhood? Well, there was the time my sister hit me in the forehead with a croquet mallet. I didn't like that. I had little concentric circles on my forehead. It was an accident. She didn't actually mean to hit me in the head, right? I mean, like, fine, right? So some people like me have had much, much, much easier lives than Joseph's. But I also know that there are other people here, and you have been deeply hurt by a sibling or by a parent or by a child or by a coworker or a boss, and there are deep, lasting wounds that you are still carrying around with you. The same kinds of wounds you might have if your brothers had sold you into slavery, and then despite your integrity, you've been falsely accused of a crime and sent to jail. Right? Those, it seems like those would be pretty high on the list, right, of things that we might think would give someone just cause to dwell in bitterness. Well, what we're going to see now is how Joseph is going to take this family that has been, I'm sorry, God is going to take this family that's been torn apart to bring Joseph and his brothers and his father back together. So here's how the story unfolds from here. The famine isn't just a famine in Egypt. The famine hits back in Canaan, where Jacob's family lives, and they don't have any food. But they've heard that Egypt has food, so they send the brothers off. And this starts a whole complicated story where Joseph, when he sees the brothers, recognizes them, but they don't recognize him, right? He looks completely different. His head's shaved. He's using an Egyptian translator. They don't recognize him. And Joseph decides he's going to test his brothers to see if their hearts have changed in the 13 years since he was sent off to prison and slavery. So what he does is he constructs a scenario where first they have to come a second time and bring Benjamin, who's the younger brother of Joseph and the only other son of the favored wife, Rachel. And Joseph can already tell that Benjamin is the new favorite. And so he's wanting to know, does the same kind of envy and spite they had for me, now do they have that for Benjamin? So he works out the test. He forces them to bring Benjamin, and then he lavishes extra stuff on Benjamin, you know, extra food, extra clothes, all this kind of stuff, to kind of stoke their envy reflexes. And then he frames Benjamin for theft and says, Benjamin will have to stay here in slavery, but the rest of you, be on your way. And he's doing this to make it as easy as possible for the brothers to get rid of Benjamin and do the same thing to him that they had done to Joseph first. But instead of repeating their past sin, something remarkable happens. One of the brothers stands up and says, no, no, no. I promised his father I would guarantee his safety. Let him go. I will take his place and spend the rest of my life as a slave here in Egypt so that he can go free. And the brother who says that is Judah. Judah is a human reclamation project to see where he was in chapter 38 to where he is now is evidence of a work of God that has taken place in his life. And I think Judah is there to remind us, however many years we have been walking away from God, and whatever sins we may have in our past, it does not mean God can't use us as part of his plan. And when Joseph sees Judah step up and volunteer to be a slave in place of Benjamin, Joseph breaks out in tears. He reveals himself to his brothers, and there's a glorious reunion and reconciliation. And they invite Dad and the whole family come to live in Egypt because there's going to be 5 more years of famine. And Joseph says, if you come here, I can feed you, I can protect you, I can take care of you. But the brothers are still wondering, is it really true that he's forgiven us? Because here's the scenario that's going through their head, and it's not an implausible one. Maybe Joseph loves Dad and still hates us. And so for the sake of Dad, he's being nice to us. But when Dad dies, we're in big trouble, right? Because all Joseph has to do is snap his fingers, and we are all dead men. So after Jacob dies, the brothers come to Joseph, and they kneel before him, and they beg for their lives. And here's what Joseph says to them. Chapter 50, last chapter of Genesis, Joseph said to them, do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones. Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them, right? This is the evidence that Joseph's forgiveness is real, right? It's not just a pose. It's not just an ulterior motive. How did Joseph forgive people who had hurt him so much? I think the crucial thing here is for Joseph's whole life, he's put God's plan and God's purposes at the center, right? And Joseph can look at his life and say, you know, the years in slavery in prison were awful. I don't think Joseph has to pretend that evil things were good or that hard things weren't hard. But he looks at the hard things and he can see how God has worked through it. Because of what happened to him, now there's actually food in Egypt and thousands of people's lives are being saved, people who would have starved to death if not for this plan of God that was bigger than even Joseph was able to understand that Joseph was a part of. In other words, Joseph believed the sovereign God was powerful enough to take even evil actions and figure out ways to use those for his plans and his purposes. And so Joseph was able to take his victimhood out of the center of the story and put God's plan and God's purposes in the center and understand the things that had happened to him in light of that. Now, at this point, some of you may be saying, you know what? Frankly, that's great for Joseph. That's not particularly helpful for me. Because Joseph, with his own two eyes, is getting to see how the bad thing led to the good thing. He was able to see how his slavery and going off to Egypt and the whole bit now is saving thousands of people's lives. Because when I look at the bad stuff that happened to me, I don't see anything good that came out of it. Certainly nothing good enough to justify the bad thing that happened. It was easy for him because he could see the promise fulfilled with his own eyes. I don't get to see that, right? Maybe some of you, that's what you're thinking right now. And here's what I want to say. Joseph and you are actually in the same boat. Because the reality is, for all of us who have trusted in God, God has made a number of promises, and there are some of those promises that we do get to see fulfilled with our eyes in this lifetime. And there are other promises of God that we have to hold on to by faith, and we don't get to see fulfilled until Jesus comes back. And which ones are which vary from person to person. But even Joseph was in the same boat, right? Some of the promises to Abraham, he gets to see fulfilled, right? He gets to see the nations being blessed. But he doesn't get to see all of the promises fulfilled. Because remember what one of the other promises was? Land. This land, Canaan, Abraham, is going to be yours and for your children and your grandchildren. And right? That was the promise. And they don't have the land yet. And the land is a big deal to them, right? Think of this overarching story, right? In Genesis 3, human sin causes us to be expelled from the land where we were dwelling with God, right? So the promise of a land where people would dwell with God is a big deal. And people are reaching the ends of their life and coming to terms with the fact that that promise isn't going to be fulfilled in their lifetime. This is true of Jacob. This is true of Joseph. I want you to see how important a theme in this text is. And we're going to go back and talk about some of the chapters I kind of skipped over. So in chapter 48, Jacob, also called Israel, says this to Joseph. He says to Joseph, "Behold, I'm about to die, but God will be with you and will bring you again to the land of your fathers." In other words, his parting word for Joseph here is to say, keep believing the promise of God about the land he has promised us. Joseph, don't forget the promise. Keep living in light of that promise. God is going to be faithful. And then Jacob says the same thing again as he's about to die. Look now in chapter 49, verse 29. Jacob says to his sons, "I am about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave in the field of Ephron the Hittite." Right now, the only bit of the promised land that Abraham's family possesses right now is a tomb. Abraham bought a tomb, and this tomb is the only thing in the promised land they have. Abraham is buried there, Isaac is buried there, and Jacob says, bury me there, right? So when Jacob dies, Egyptians were good at this sort of thing. They embalm him, and they take a whole like procession, including like Pharaoh's cabinet basically goes with him, right? And there's this big production of burying Jacob in the promised land in this tomb, right? Which is Jacob's way of, with his death, making a statement, this is our home. Keep believing that this is our home. And when Joseph dies, he does something similar but a little different, right? In chapter 50, verse 24, just before he dies, Joseph says, "I'm about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." And then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, "God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here." So just to be clear on what Joseph is saying, when I die, the Egyptians are going to embalm my body to preserve it. We're going to keep it in a safe place, probably one where you see it regularly. Like, oh yes, there's the tomb of Joseph. That's where Joseph's body is. And every time you see my tomb, or every time you see my mummy, you are going to remember that my bones don't stay here forever. My body is going to be a testimony generation after generation after generation that Egypt is not home. And one day, God is going to be faithful to his promise. And in his faithfulness to the promise, he's going to take you home to the promised land, and you're going to take my body with you. Jacob and Joseph and the people of Israel were still having to live by faith, believing in a promise they didn't get to see fulfilled with their own eyes in their own lifetime. And that is what we are called to do. Now, as we take a step back and we look at the story, one of the questions we might be answering or asking ourselves is, what about that first promise? Remember back in Genesis 3, when human beings sin and the curse of sin begins, there's this note of hope that one day one is going to come who's going to crush the serpent. And Joseph seems the closest to a serpent crusher we've seen so far. Compared to everyone else we've met in the book of Genesis, Joseph seems to be a man of integrity, a man of hope, a man who gives God the glory and God the credit, who orients his life around God's plan. But the very end of the book of Genesis is Joseph dies. And Joseph dies, and the curse of sin still hasn't been removed. And so we're still wondering, where is the person going to come from who's going to destroy the curse? Now we're thinking, well, it's got to be one of their descendants, right? So clearly it's going to be one of Joseph's descendants. Clearly Joseph's earned the right for one of his descendants to be the Savior. But if you go back and you look at the end of Genesis, at the prophecies that Jacob makes about each of his sons, he prophesies that the future king is going to come from the line of Judah. Because your place in God's plan ultimately isn't about your works and your merit. If you take their character over the course of their lives, Joseph clearly beats Judah. But I think God is making a statement about the nature of grace by taking someone like Judah and saying, through you, I am going to bring the one who is ultimately going to fulfill all the promises of God, Jesus Christ. So here's the challenge for us. All of us have dreams, and all of us have stories we tell ourselves about who we are and where we came from and how we got here. And for many of you, when you tell that story inside yourself, you find yourself rehearsing over and over again the wrongs that have been done to you. The same way Joseph had wrongs that had been done to him. And here is the question: what is that story you tell about your journey from birth till now? And where does God and his promise and his plan fit in that story you tell of your own history? Is it in the center, or is it on the margins? Or is it completely absent? Because what Joseph did is view his whole life story in light of God's plans and God's promises. How do you see your identity? Joseph saw himself as a servant, right? And you look forward, and it's interesting. You see Jesus leaving the throne of God and humbling himself to become a servant, to be obedient to death, even death on a cross. You see the Apostle Paul boasting about the fact that he is a servant, a slave of Jesus Christ. And as he's in prison, trying to figure out how his imprisonment is going to be a blessing to God, a blessing to God's people, and further the work of the kingdom. That's the kind of story we need to have for ourselves, right? Who we are, if we have been adopted into Abraham's family because of our faith in Jesus Christ, then we too get to be part of that promise that all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed, right? We get to participate in being a blessing to all people. And what about your future dreams? Joseph has a dream of himself in preeminence and other people bowing down to him. And he could have taken that dream and made it all about him and all about his glory. But what Joseph did instead is he took that dream and he understood it in light of the promises of God and understood that it wasn't actually about him. And that's why at every opportunity, Joseph is working to make sure God gets the credit and God is the one at the center of his dreams for the future. I want to urge you in your connection groups, talk about that. Talk about how the story of your life looks different if you change the frame and put God at the center. Would you pray with me? Father, you are writing a story from Eden to the new heavens and the new earth. And it is a privilege for your sons and your daughters who have believed in Jesus Christ to be a part of the story you are writing. God, help us to believe that you will be faithful to your promises. And help us to understand our stories in light of your promise and your plan, Lord, with you at the center of the story that we tell. Father, we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.